Several weeks ago, when New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft was among nearly 300 people arrested for purchasing sex at a Florida massage parlor owned by a woman who was also selling access to President Trump at his Mar-a-Lago resort, the issue of human trafficking, including but not limited to sex trafficking, hit the front pages of newspapers and social media around the country. Apparently, the women are among some 20 million victims of human trafficking worldwide, about 20% of whom are trafficked for sex. But what does this even mean? How does a human get trafficked? Who's making money off this practice and how do they capture victims? What makes people vulnerable? Are all victims of human trafficking brought across national borders or are some of them trafficked even within the country? Are there human trafficking victims in Kentucky? It's Ethics Forward on 106.5 FM Forward Radio in lovely downtown Louisville, Kentucky. My name is Avery Cullers. I teach philosophy at U of L, and each week I bring you the insights of scholars, activists, and practitioners regarding ethical issues in our daily lives and social institutions. This week I'm excited to be in Frankfurt to talk to two members of Attorney General Andy Beshear's staff focused on human trafficking and child protection. They are Allison Taylor, who directs the Office of Child Abuse and Human Trafficking Prevention and Prosecution, and Gretchen Hunt, Director of the Office of Victims Advocacy. I'll be asking them about the nature and prevalence of human trafficking, how it's connected to broader political and economic systems, whom it hurts, whom it benefits, and whether we can do anything to stop it. We'll be back in a moment with Allison Taylor and Gretchen Hunt from the Attorney General's Office. Don't go away! Ethics Forward is back with Allison Taylor and Gretchen Hunt, who work in the Attorney General's Office fighting human trafficking. Allison and Gretchen, welcome to Ethics Forward.
Thank you so much.
Can you start us off by saying briefly what you do in the AG's office? Have your offices always existed, or have they been created in the recent past, and if so, why? Allison, can you start?
Sure. The Office of Child Abuse and Human Trafficking Prevention and Prosecution was actually just created in January of 2016 when Attorney General Beshear was sworn in. Protecting children is one of his top four priorities and one of the missions that we all work toward here within the Attorney General's office. So to give it that full focus and weight that he wanted to see in that priority, he developed a separate office to work specifically on child abuse protection and human trafficking prevention and prosecution. And again, that started in 2016.
Perfect. Thanks.
And the Office of Victims Advocacy has been in existence since the mid-80s when the Crime Victims Bill of Rights was passed in Kentucky statute, and it was part of a movement nationally really to safeguard victims' rights within the criminal justice system. So we've existed. I would say the upgrade in our office, so to speak, has been that under the current Attorney General, Andy Beshear, we have had a heightened focus on victim-centered and trauma-informed investigations and prosecutions and have expanded staff and programming around, you know, issues such as human trafficking, but also the rape kit backlog.
Okay. Okay. Good. Thank you. And so underlying question, just in case, what does an Attorney General do? And like, how do your jobs fit into the structure of the Attorney General's office?
I mean, the easiest way to talk about the role of the Attorney General is that he or she is the people's attorney. They're the chief law enforcement agent for the state in Kentucky. They're the head of what's called the Unified Prosecutorial System. That's the role writ large. But as Allison alluded to, under General Beshear, our four-part mission has been to seek justice for victims of rape and sexual assault, prevent and prosecute child abuse, including exploitation and human trafficking of kids, protect our seniors, and find workable solutions to the opioid epidemic. And so Allison and I work diligently with our staff every day to really push those missions, as do our prosecutors, our law enforcement, our civil attorneys, and all the 200-plus folks in this office who work towards that mission. So at least under this administration, that's been the focus, is that four-part mission.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you. To human trafficking, by now most of us have seen posters and stickers on backs of cars and on restaurants, hotels and other establishments with hotline numbers. Or maybe for some people it only rose to consciousness when Robert Kraft was arrested. So it seems that this issue is a growing concern, or has appeared, in fact, in recent years. Is that true, or is it just that there's a new attempt to stop it? Or if it is growing, why is it growing? Where does it come from?
I think that we see trafficking and awareness of trafficking becoming more in the forefront, just like we did 20 years ago with domestic violence. You saw more professionals being required to be trained on dealing with the cycle of violence and power and control. folks like Gretchen and people at Catholic Charities have been leading the way on raising awareness for a long time. But here in the last few years, we've really seen a more increased awareness of it and understanding of what it is. And that's just because of bringing different parties in to help raise the awareness, you know, to take on some of that work that they had been doing previously and continue to do, but adding more people to the mission. For example, I was a domestic violence prosecutor for a lot of years and would have never thought I'd be dealing with trafficking. And then I came here to work under a different administration, and that's when Gretchen and Marissa and Sandy Overly and others were writing our human trafficking laws. And so that was my sort of introduction into what this really was. And, you know, now here, 6 years later, I'm lucky enough to go around and train and talk to people around the state about it. So it's with every new mission, you bring more people on to the Army, and I think that that's really what we're seeing now and why we see so much new awareness.
Right. So you're, if I'm understanding correctly, if the analogy with domestic violence works, then human trafficking has always been around and has always been an issue, but we're becoming more proactive about it and more aware of it.
And I think part of that awareness in the early 2000s when I was practicing immigration law, and that was my entree into this, was working with immigrant survivors of various crimes, including trafficking. And in those early ages, we didn't really recognize U.S. citizens as much as being victims of trafficking. We saw it more of a problem of folks who were often new arrivals here who were exploited because either they didn't have immigration documents, or they were dependent on their employer for immigration documents, or they didn't know labor laws, they didn't know the language, and we saw a lot of exploitation in those groups. That still continues, but I think what has changed over, I would say, the past 5 to 8 years has been a real attention on the vulnerabilities, in particular of American youth, runaways, kids in the foster care system. And that has really changed, I think, the public consciousness, because it's starting to be seen a little bit more as a more prevalent problem across communities, whether they're rural and urban. And Allison can speak much more detail about that and how that has played out in terms of training and investigations in our office. But I think that's what changed the consciousness, at least in Kentucky, over the past 2 decades.
Right.
Since 2016, when Attorney General Beshear took office, we've trained well over 10,000 people across the state. And we've determined that everybody has a critical role to play. So, for example, we'll go and train firefighters and fire inspectors because they're going into businesses. And we'll train social workers. We train teachers. We train truck drivers, ER nurses, you know, people in the healthcare system, local health departments. There are just all these different groups that have an ability in their daily lives, but then also in their professional lives, to identify it. And it never fails that at every training, there's one person who comes up afterward and says, I've seen that, but I didn't know to give it that name. Right. I didn't know I had a duty to report that. Right. I didn't know it was trafficking because I always had those same misconceptions that it's like that movie I saw, or that it only involves foreign nationals. And so we're really breaking through those misconceptions, and that's leading to a lot more identification.
Wow, so there's a lot going on. It's very rich. So if taking a couple steps back first to the connection to immigration, I guess I would have thought that it was that people who had crossed national borders would be particularly vulnerable because of maybe lack of legal rights within this country and so on. In the first place, I would like to know what the specific ways that human trafficking affects immigrant communities or people who are not originally from here. But also if you can distinguish between trafficking and smuggling of people.
Sure. So smuggling refers to crossing of international borders and evading the legal ports of entry, basically. And it is usually seen as sort of a consensual exchange where one party pays a smuggler a fee, and at the end of the smuggling, of the crossing of the border, that transaction is done. Now, there is a lot of exploitation. There's a lot of sexual violence that happens on that route. Sometimes people can steal the money, but that's the idea, that it's a set transaction. Trafficking can happen in one block of Frankfort, Kentucky or Louisville, Kentucky. It doesn't have to require any movement, actually, even though we think traffic and we think of car traffic, but it actually doesn't require movement. People are often moved, makes them more vulnerable and detached and isolated. But trafficking is The exploitation of folks for forced labor or services or commercial sex through either force, fraud, or coercion. And the only exception to that is that if it's commercial sex, any child under 18 is a victim, whether or not there's force, fraud, or coercion. We've essentially said in state law, in federal law, in international law, that kids can't consent to being sold for sex.
Right.
And so trafficking is really about that relationship between the exploiter and the victim. And that's what you're really looking at. It's not so much the movement, even though that can happen. To your question about foreign nationals, I think the vulnerability exists because many people are coming to this country as economic migrants. So they already are seeking a better life. And so they may be very prone to promises of fraud, that you're going to have a better job, you're going to get to learn English, you're going to get to go to school, you're going to get this wage. Sometimes they come in on legal visas and are promised all those things, right, and the situation changes. So a good example is nurses from the Philippines that were brought in and then were exploited in a whole different role. So sometimes it's even legal migrants. It's not just undocumented, right, migrants. But I think those communities are high risk. But as Allison sees all the time, kids in Eastern Kentucky and in all over who are happen to be born into situations where their parents may be addicted to drugs, may be just as vulnerable to being trafficked for those drugs. So we see vulnerability kind of across sectors. The common denominator is that the community or the individual is vulnerable, often through economic vulnerability or prior victimization or substance abuse. Something else has made that person be at risk.
Right. Right. And so just to clarify, people use the term something like child prostitution. There is no such thing, you're saying. That's
correct.
By definition. That's
right.
Okay. And it's exploitation of vulnerability for the profit of the smuggler, right? And not only exploitation of vulnerability, but also subjection to force, fraud, or coercion in doing that, right?
Yeah, you're being subjected to forced labor or services. So it can be a job that you're paid, or you can be kept as a slave in a house,
right,
a servant in a house. And the way that they do that is through force, fraud, or coercion. Usually a lot of psychological coercion. It's rare that you see necessarily, you know, chains or locks or beatings. That,
right,
does happen. Sexual abuse happens a lot in both labor and sex trafficking, but typically it's that psychological manipulation and coercion to make someone feel like they're not free to go.
Right. Allison, you mentioned doing trainings, and I guess I know that this isn't we don't have the time and this isn't the place to do a training, but very, very briefly, like, what are people who recognize human trafficking looking for? How do you recognize it? And what industries are people, do we see it in, I guess?
Well, I think it's going to depend on what we're talking about. Are we talking about sex trafficking, or are we talking about labor trafficking? Like Gretchen said, you can have labor trafficking victims who are inside a private home. So that's one of the reasons, for example, UPS is training all their drivers so that when they go up to a house, you know, to deliver a package, they have an insight into some things to look for. You know, is there someone there who is speaking for the person? If we're talking about labor trafficking or sex trafficking, mm-hmm, in those kinds of cases. There are physical injuries a lot of times, because when these manipulations stop working, or if a victim tries to free themselves from those psychological manipulations, a lot of times their abuse will begin to keep them compliant. So we do see a lot of physical injuries in both sex trafficking and labor trafficking. Any type of business, especially with foreign nationals being employed or working there, because they don't know their rights. U.S. citizens, when we go to work at a business, we know our rights. And so we are far less likely to be labor trafficked,
right,
in that sense. And not saying it can't happen, but we're less likely.
Right.
So that is why foreign nationals are much more at risk or able to be manipulated in those types of situations. When it comes to sex trafficking, a lot of that's going to be online.
Uh-huh.
With online sex ads, but there are also things like the Asian massage parlors, residential brothels. There are groups that travel circuits that go to different events. You know, there are different ways that we'll see those present, but we want someone in each of those situations to know some of the things that I can look for. You know, somebody who doesn't seem free to move. When we train a hotel staff, we'll say, are they checking in with no bags? Are they coming for, you know, checking in for 2 days, but they have no bags with them?
Right.
When we train people who might be dealing with victims directly, do they have multiple cell phones? Do they have multiple hotel key cards, you know, for different hotels at one time. If they're juveniles and they're really poor and they suddenly have all these expensive things, someone is giving them those things.
Right.
So that could be an indicator. So there's really no set list. You know, you check the box and if you have 5 of 8, you've got a trafficking victim. But there are a lot of things that can give you that gut feeling that something's not right, and we need to know what to call that something's not right. One of the trends that we're really seeing with juvenile sex trafficking victims and those who do the work that I think will help hopefully change some of these misconceptions about trafficking is commercial sexual exploitation of children. You know, to start calling it that instead of human trafficking. Just because human trafficking is a word that has gotten these movie ideas attached to it, or that it's only foreign nationals. So what we're, when we talk about juvenile sex trafficking, we're talking about the exploitation of children in a commercial setting. And maybe that's easier to have less baggage with it, for, you know, for lack of a better term. So there are a lot of different things that we're doing to give people that insight, but it also a lot of it depends on the group that you're with and which topic you're talking about. So that's why they are very, you know, 2-3-4 hour trainings for these different groups.
Right. And so in the case of foreign nationals, I guess one of the worries that they would have is that if they escape, they will be deported back into the very peril that got them. Is there what kinds of protections would they have so that they, if they do escape and sort of present themselves to the police, they are protected rather than left rightless?
There's a number of protections. So still under federal law, any person on U.S. soil has a right to access emergency services, go to the ER, report to law enforcement, call the fire department, you know, seek services at a local rape crisis center, or domestic violence program, or child advocacy center. So victims of crime should be able to access all those protections, go to the courts, get protective orders, file a criminal complaint. But beyond that, immigrants are very frightened, I think, in most situations, and in trafficking situations even more so. And so Congress passed legislation over the past really 2 decades to set up a number of protections for victims of trafficking in particular. So there are particular crime victim visas that Congress passed because they knew law enforcement also had a really hard time prosecuting those who exploit victims of trafficking who are non-citizens. So they wanted law enforcement to have a tool too. If you want to have your witness here and you want to be able to make sure that they stay through the course of the investigation and the prosecution, you want to make sure that they're not going to be deported. And so there are a variety of visas, UNT visas both apply potentially to victims of trafficking. And with those visas would come ability to stay here, ability to work. And in the case of the T visa, which is for trafficking victims, it also can allow that individual to get the same benefits that refugees get. So 90 days of assistance with housing and ESL classes and a lot more wraparound services. The other thing is that non-citizens who are victims of trafficking can get is intensive case management and victim services. So in Kentucky, that's through the Bakita Empowerment Initiative through Catholic Charities of Louisville that does work with international survivors of trafficking as well as domestic. And so there is a lot of support out there. The challenge is getting that information into the hands and the ears of trafficking survivors who are often very isolated. In my own experience, though, this is vital information for all U.S. citizens to have, because they may be the Good Samaritan neighbor next door to the domestic servant. They may be the individual who gets their nails done regularly and develops some rapport with somebody and starts to hear the story behind the person doing their nails.
Yeah.
And if a U.S. citizen is empowered, or somebody who's, you know, Good Samaritan, to know a little bit about this, that there may be rights and protections out there, that can be the difference, and that can help save a life of an immigrant victim who may then decide, you know what, it is safe for me to go somewhere and talk to somebody about what's going on.
Right. I guess I would wonder about the responsibilities assumed or the assumptions made by a would-be Good Samaritan. I guess I have this image of a would-be Good Samaritan calling your office or something, and then what if you're wrong? What happens to people if you report incorrectly, you know, out of good intentions, but nonetheless?
Do you think, well, we always suggest for people to have, and hopefully your listeners will plug this into their phone, the National Human Trafficking Hotline, which routes through our office too. We get a copy of those calls basically that come in. And that's 1-888 3737888. I'm sure you can share it in some other way. But calls go into the National Human Trafficking Hotline, and they will help triage and figure out. If it's just a tip, if I suspect that there's a restaurant I go to or a horse farm I go to, or I think that there's exploitation going on there, I want somebody to look into it. The hotline will then triage out. Does that mean we need to pass this on to law enforcement? Is it just a tip that we record? Is it a victim calling for services that we're going to link up immediately with victim services? So there's not really a lot of harm. And Allison, maybe you could speak to the child abuse reporting angle of it, which is the duty, in fact, to report.
And that's where it's hard. When I do trainings, we get a lot of questions about if I have an adult who I think this is happening to, who can I call and make that adult get out of the situation? And I, you know, explain to those folks, it's just like with domestic violence or other types of trauma bond like that, that you have to give them the resource that when they're ready, they will take and use. And so it's one thing that I always talk about is having victims call the human trafficking hotline, because they can call there and say, no, I don't want law enforcement involved. I just need to ride out, you know, and we will never know that they called. And that's fine. Even though we want to prosecute cases and we want to arrest bad guys and girls, we want victims to get out of the situation, obviously. So they can always call. But when it comes to a kid, an underage person, under 18, if we have any suspicion at all that a juvenile is involved in labor trafficking or forced labor services, dependency, neglect, or abuse, for that matter, as well as commercial sexual activity, so any type of exchange of something of value for sexual activity, then there's a legal duty that applies to all of us. Every single person, no matter of our profession, of our situation in life, we all have the obligation to call the Kentucky Cabinet of Health and Family Services, DCBS hotline, and it's a central intake system, and you give them the information that you have. And if you're wrong, it's no harm, no foul. You're not held accountable for anything. But if you're right, just think how important it is that you made that call.
Right.
So you don't have to have a bunch of evidence or, you know, do surveillance or anything like that. Go get witnesses. You just have to have the suspicion and make the call, and then we can take it from there.
Right. Got it. And is that the same number?
877-KYSAFE1. KY Safe 1.
Okay. KY for Kentucky Safe 1. 877. Yes. Okay. Awesome. Thank you. So it's about 20 years old now, but this book by Kevin Bales, Disposable People, detailed sort of this phenomenon of modern slavery and explicated the way that people become modern slaves, not because the legal system will respect the ownership rights of the owner, as it were, the slave owner, over the enslaved person, but that particularly the use of debt and other forms of lack of resources that make the person dependent, sort of radically dependent on their exploiter. And I guess it strikes me that you're describing a zone of the law where what you're trying to do is get around that modern slavery problem. Is that right? Do you feel like that the laws that we have in the books satisfy that, or what more laws would you write are people still able, or like exploiters still able to take advantage of debt and lack of resources to control people?
People absolutely can. Now, one of the things in 2013, the Kentucky General Assembly passed a comprehensive bill, the Kentucky Human Trafficking Victims' Rights Act. And there was a provision there that didn't get quite as much attention, but it was a wage theft provision. So in a lot of cases of labor exploitation, the person simply isn't paid, in addition to debt bondage of holding a debt over their head. And we created a provision there where an attorney could sue for treble damages, which the practical reality of that means that lawyers would actually take these cases because they could get paid.
Oh, right, of course.
And so for people who couldn't afford to hire an attorney, it's a roofer, it's a tobacco, you know, person working on a tobacco farm. They don't have a lot of resources, but they could do that. That was one attempt to try to look at that, but I would say that there's still a lot, and what a number of advocates, both locally and nationally, look at is there still needs to be a lot more beefed up protections in the labor context. There's still a lot of areas of employment, domestic servants are one of them, that are kind of unregulated. They're not looked at by a lot of our labor laws, and I would say that that's really the biggest challenge, both on a public awareness level and on a law enforcement level, is that a lot of these zones are really invisible, right, and they're made less visible. So we don't see our hotel workers who clean our rooms, typically. That's right. Done for a purpose. At a truck stop, the trucks go in a separate entrance, and it's hidden often by a wall. Right. You may not see the kids who go or the women who go from cab to cab seeking someone to pay for a sex act. So we don't see who produces the coffee or the chocolate bar.
Right.
That's made invisible, that it's made by child slaves on the Ivory Coast.
Right.
I mean, so there's a lot of, I would say, almost constructed invisibility, both in our law and our culture,
right,
that make it more comfortable for us as consumers to not really think critically about what happened before we bought this thing.
Right.
And that's the challenge, I would say, of modern day slavery, more so than years ago during African slavery, where there was a lot more open exploitation. The last thing I'll say is that during abolition, many people said we can't get rid of African slavery, even though we know it's immoral because it's so embedded in our economic system. It's just impossible.
Right.
And, you know, in some ways, I feel like people still respond to that way about exploitation right now, but it absolutely is possible. And we're seeing ways to disrupt those chains of exploitation.
Right. How powerful are the image I have is, especially if you talk about, truck stops or something like that, or even hotel workers, I have the image of like a kind of a very sort of neighborhood level boss who controls several people, but isn't really like Amazon scale of economic power. And so you'd think that there wouldn't be a strong lobby against doing something to improve the situation. So why doesn't it happen? Sorry, maybe that's a naive question.
I think in a way, if it's like a mom and pop small employer or a smaller criminal enterprise, I actually think our law enforcement structure is a little better equipped to see that as crime in some ways,
mm-hmm.
or even the larger criminal enterprises. But I think the labor exploitation rings are sometimes harder to discern because they don't exist necessarily in conjunction with other crime, with drug trafficking,
right,
with other criminal offenses. And so those sometimes require more insightful collaboration, often between cooperation between those who enforce labor laws and those who enforce our criminal laws. Again, in Kentucky in 2013, we passed a law that said that the Kentucky Labor Cabinet had to report to law enforcement anytime they suspect labor trafficking. We don't really know. That's not under our purview here at the Office of the Attorney General. So we don't know whether that, in fact, is kind of a provision that's being worked on or whether we could bolster it some more. But that was an attempt to try to make that connection. These are hard networks to disrupt.
Right.
The massage parlor circuits are hard to disrupt. A lot of labor exploitation can be very challenging. It can be this vast scheme of immigration fraud and other types of fraud that are hard to break up.
Right.
And I think another is that idea of forced fraud or coercion, when we prove that as prosecutors, we have to go by what's in the mind of the victim, not what we think is coercive.
Right.
So when you're dealing with other cultures where certain activities, bring dishonor to the family or other things that to us in our culture, that doesn't seem like something that would coerce someone to stay in a situation,
right,
that is ultimately slavery. So when we're asking the questions of victims, if we're not asking them the right way, if we're not asking them in a culturally sensitive, not just trauma-informed, but also culture-informed, then we're not getting the answers that we need to be able to prove that,
right,
most important element in these situations. What makes it, wage and hour violations versus labor trafficking is going to be that forced fraud or coercion.
Right.
And so if we're not asking it in a way that they answer it where we can give that proof to a jury, then a lot of times the labor trafficking doesn't seem to be there. And so we've been lucky to have a lot of opportunity from victim services who serve different cultures from those cultures come in and say,
right,
this is how you want to approach someone from this culture. If you're a male and, the victim is a female, you're going to want to do this instead of something else, which might be a slight to them,
right,
or be scary or what turn them off or shut them down. And so we've had to really learn outside of just the law and what we know to do regularly when it comes to working with foreign nationals. And these cases, like Gretchen said, that can reach not just across the U.S., but also far outside of the United States and have all these different tentacles that pour into them.
Right. This is Ethics Forward on WFMP 106.5 FM Forward Radio in lovely downtown Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm talking with Gretchen Hunt and Allison Taylor of the Attorney General's Office. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm back with Allison Taylor and Gretchen Hunt of the Attorney General's Office, working on victims advocacy and human trafficking. Allison, you were talking about the need for a culturally informed, as well as trauma-informed awareness and interventions. And I guess I wondered if you could say more about what the prevention aspect of your job. You've sort of referred to that as intervention. You've talked about trainings, and you're focused on both prevention and prosecution. So can you say what else goes into the mix, sort of upstream, to reduce the likelihood that people will be vulnerable in these ways, or that people can be trafficked?
Well, I certainly think that there are a lot of policy-level things that we could implement that aren't just specifically trafficking-related that would keep people from being as vulnerable, especially, you know, my focus primarily is on our youth, especially when we have youth who are in the foster care system, in the juvenile justice system. Those kids are going to be more at risk. Right. Kids who are being raised by parents who are drug addicted and not around to keep an eye on them or be trusted adults. Right. So a lot of what I do with intervention or prevention is, when we do training, focus on groups like your school counselors. In the summer, I'm going to be able to train all of our public school bus drivers, and they're going to see every day that kid getting on the bus and know if something has changed with that child, and talk about how this recruitment actually happens. Because again, there's so many misconceptions of this kidnapping type situation or foreign nationals and smuggling situation. Mm-hmm. And so that they can see, when I hear a kid talking about certain things or behaviors that they're finding from an adult who's trying to get them to come along into one of these situations, that we can stop it there.
Right.
And then also teaching kids to listen forward in each other, because they're far more likely to talk to their friends about this person that they've met that's going to give them this great opportunity or love them so much or whatever the angle is. And so that's really is the one-on-one intervention is what we really focus on, especially when it comes to juveniles. Then there are broad policy things that can be done that are honestly much harder than getting people to look out for their neighbor or care about the kid down the street.
Right.
And so those are long-term battles that we face. For example, we've tried now, this is what, the third year that we've tried to pass a bill that would require folks applying for a commercial driver's license permit to take a 25-minute online training course and print out a certificate. And when they go apply for their permit, they would prove with that certificate that they had taken this identifying trafficking training.
Right.
And we've yet, to be able to get that passed. It costs no money. No one's opposed to it. It doesn't affect anyone who's currently holding a CDL. And so it's just a real common sense, easy way to be an intervener in one area of our world, which are those truck stops. Truck drivers have an opportunity to make a call when they see that happening on the lot if they know what to look for.
Right.
So it's just, and as that training continues, traffickers will say, hey, there's all these truck drivers being trained. That's maybe not a good place to go anymore.
Right.
And so there's your intervention.
Right.
And so it's just big policy things that can actually be accomplished really easily if everybody will just work together on those things.
Right.
And I would say in some ways this whole office and the mission that General Bashir has set out is a lot about that early primary prevention, because addressing the opioid epidemic would do wonders to prevent a lot of trafficking of Kentucky youth. So some of the things we're doing in other areas are not even named as prevention of trafficking, but if they're improving child well-being and enhancing safety and well-being of all Kentuckians, they are very much disrupting possible trafficking. You know, you look at vulnerability of anybody around the world of why they would come into a job that looks like you and I might say, ooh, that looks shady.
Right.
It's poverty. So any of our other efforts to return money back to Kentuckians to help consumers, I think still position people to have some protective factors where they might have been the family that next month didn't have money to pay rent because of their utility bills and would have traded their kid for a month's rent. We don't know what we've disrupted, but the work of this office in helping consumers, also because it's that protective work, could be disrupting trafficking right. as well, because it's disrupting poverty.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's a catch-22, right? It sounds like it's exacerbated by sort of dissolution of small-scale social networks and close-knit communities and so on. But of course, I stopped myself and said it's a catch-22 because maybe there are aspects of close-knit communities that make it more prevalent. And so there's not one, I don't know if the word is, it's not a single cause thing.
I think people can be vulnerable and trapped in smaller communities. And also we have seen, I think, at least in my experience, that sometimes small rural communities really wrap around survivors, even if they're immigrants. And one would immediately think that maybe they're really an outsider, they've wrapped around. I've seen that with domestic servitude cases and others.
And one thing I think that we really don't focus on enough is the familial trafficking, where, you know, family members, like Gretchen said, are trafficking their own family members.
Right.
Especially when it comes to kids, we know that half of the kids who are sex trafficked are trafficked by their own family members.
Right.
And we're talking very young children. And so until we get to a point where we're recognizing that for what it is and calling it what it is and prosecuting it as human trafficking, I think we're going to see that continue, as just like Gretchen said, while all these other things that put families in a position to be willing to do that to their own. And think about the effect that it has on a kid who, we're going to lose our place to live if I don't have sex with this person.
Right.
You know, we're talking long-term health impacts. We're talking trauma that could last, well, will last for a long time, that if not dealt with, could enter into more drug addiction and more behavior on a cyclical pattern. So it's really a big problem in our rural communities just as much, even if they don't have that big city corner that they think someone might be standing on, or that ability to interact with all these other nationalities or immigrants. It all takes different forms based on where you are and who you're dealing with.
Right.
So it's a much bigger problem when you're trying to wrap your head around it and give a reason for why it's happening. It's just much bigger than that, depending on where you are and what group you're talking about and what type of trafficking.
Right.
So it's really hard to pin down.
Right.
And the positive thing, I think, is that training absolutely results in more safety. Mm-hmm. So there was an example several years ago of a colleague of ours, Brittany Thomas, who had trained a group of nursing students and nurses at University of Kentucky Hospital. And it happened to be that a woman escaped a trafficking situation on a farm in Bourbon County. She was 6 or 7 months pregnant when she fled. On one day, she was not accompanied to go to the restroom, and she just started running. She ran 10 miles, basically collapsed. EMS or first responders came. They took her to the hospital. That hospital had recently been trained on trafficking, and they screened her effectively for labor trafficking. She had access to services. There was investigation, there was a federal prosecution, the trafficker was held accountable, and that all came from most likely, you know, the good solid actions of many people, the people who we were training, the people who were trained, the first responders who did what they could in spite of language barriers and not knowing all the resources maybe that would be available to this individual. So I would say that that's the flip side as well of feeling like maybe small communities can't do a lot, or Kentucky has challenges around this, that we have seen communities wrap around and really do the right thing and identify and get somebody access to services, and then the prosecution too.
Right. So on the issue of familial trafficking then, and I guess I don't know the situation that you're describing in the horse farm, whether it was familiar or not, but the kinds of cases you're describing as familial, like under what conditions are people so desperate that they will sell their child, you know, sexually to make rent? In cases like that, the alarm bells that ring for me are that taking this in the direction of prosecution just ensures that the family is broken up and has the result that they were trying to avoid, that even the child might have themselves thought was even worse than what they went through. Does that make sense? So the I guess familial trafficking seems like a particularly fraught thing precisely because of how, because it's not sort of simple like some profiting kingpin making tons of money off it. It's the second worst thing, right? And so I guess how do we make sure that the that intervention and prosecution doesn't just bring about the result that was even worse that they were trying to avoid?
Well, I think you're being kind that the reason the familial trafficking is happening is because they were trying to avoid being separated. The most common fact pattern for familial trafficking is the parent who allows a drug dealer to have sex with their kid in exchange for drugs.
Oh my gosh.
And they're not doing that because they want to keep the family together. They're doing that because they're drug addicted.
Right.
And that takes precedent over everything else.
Right.
So to me, we know that a lot of kids don't report, whether it's sexual abuse generally or sex trafficking, commercial sexual activity, because of that bond with their family,
right?
Because they may be separated. But that's not going to keep us from prosecuting those cases, because right now the way things are, those parents know that they may end up in family court for that, you know, getting substance abuse treatment. They may end up with their child in foster care for a while, but reunification is always going to be the goal. I don't know that that won't still be the goal, but until there's some real consequences for parents, and this is just my opinion, but until there are some real consequences for parents who see, you know, a child as a commodity to trade for drugs,
right?
Yeah, I don't know that we're going to see a change in it. Now, obviously, those bigger interventions, drug treatment, access to, you know, help, those would be great, but we're not seeing that what we're doing so far is changing that. And once that child has been, you know, traded to the drug dealer once a week or whatever, that's something that is going to cause long-term effects that we're also going to have to repair.
Right.
So I think that we can give parents other tools, but if they're even thinking that that's a good option, then there's something that's already going wrong before we get there. There aren't very many parents who think, I can't make the rent this month, I'll let the landlord have sex with my kid.
Right.
You know,
right.
So it's a different, I can't explain why they do it, honestly. So it's a different thing to deal with than why someone would, you know, enslave someone to make a profit by getting labor that's
right.
cheaper than what they would have to pay were they doing it legally. So it's just, it's a different dynamic, and it's really hard to deal with. And I wish I had all the answers.
And I think what you're really speaking to is the trauma of trafficking. Both Allison and I have worked with many survivors of multiple different types of crime. And one of the things you see often with trafficking is that it's incredibly traumatic and painful because it usually involves a disruption of trust. Usually there's some trust with the person. So even in a lot of labor trafficking, it was someone the family knew and thought they could trust.
Right.
And so the core of this crime, whether it's labor or sex, and I've seen serious trauma responses in both labor and sex trafficking victims. While we usually understand the crime of sex trafficking as being viscerally awful, labor trafficking also really results in great trauma to the individual. Being treated as less than human really does a number
right.
to a human being. And so one of the things is it involves a breaking of trust almost in everyone. And that is incredibly traumatic. It
yeah.
makes that person feel as if they can't trust anybody in the world after that. And that has to be repaired through a lot of hard work. And the second is that a lot of trafficking survivors are victims of multiple crimes. So you often see childhood yeah. victimization. And so the cumulative impact of the trauma is big. And I think what are the important takeaways of that is that you have to have a victim-centered intervention. Not everyone is going to want to investigate and prosecute criminally.
Right.
Some people may want to sue civilly. They may want to get other protections. They may just want to get services. They may want to get out for that night and have a safe bed in a hotel room and then kind of figure things out again. And what the point of our office, and I think the anti-trafficking movement is you try to meet the victim where they are, restore their agency, their sense of choice, their sense of control over the situation, do safety planning, but meet them where they are.
Right.
And the other part of it is that we need to be concerned downstream about all those different crimes. We need to be concerned about domestic violence and child abuse and these other crimes that may not be the central focus right now, but they often appear with that individual. And, you know, that's, it's just really, really critical. It's also really critical, I think, for those who serve trafficking victims to understand the level of trauma and victimization. And so one of the things our office has worked with other partners through a region in the Southeast is to come up with guiding principles for victim, for agencies serving victims of trafficking. Because we have a lot of well-intentioned people who try to serve this population who don't really have the background and training in trauma.
Right.
And I'm working with this high-level victimization. So we really want those who are interested in getting more involved in this to also have the tools and the awareness of kind of how to really work with victims who often present with very complex trauma.
Right. Wow. Do you have a, you had phone numbers for the trafficking hotline and KY Safe One. Do you have like a, where does someone go if they are, if they want to sort of have a career in that, for instance, or just want to know how to do, how to implement that within their career?
Get a lot of calls asking that question, actually. And so I think it depends on where you want to go with your career, obviously.
Yeah.
But when I have folks who are interested in doing victim services work or something other than law enforcement, because that's a different area, that's a different direction that you're going to take. I say go volunteer. Go volunteer to start out with at an advocacy group. You know, whether it's Free to Hope in Louisville or Victory Through Grace or one of these other organizations across the state, and get in at that level first and determine whether this is how you really want to go. And then if you want to do social work, if you want to do medicine, you'll have that background to move toward that sort of specification. But people think that there's some group out there that's just like out, you know, with their capes and their hero gear, and it's so much bigger and it takes such a big partnership that there's a place for all these different professions, but you got to start out and kind of get your feet wet and see where you're going to fit in best. And so that's usually my first recommendation, is just call your local advocacy group and say, where can I volunteer and how can
right.
I help?
Right.
That's, I mean, Gretchen may have a another idea, but that's, I think, step one.
Yeah, do big brothers, big sisters, mentor youth. See if your local domestic violence or rape crisis center has volunteer training, because those are going to be good skill building for how to deal with victims of trauma. And then, you know, I know that some students love graphic design, so they helped with a recent National Labor Trafficking Conference that we held in Louisville and did these wonderful displays on fair trade and slave labor and
right.
The history of slavery in the United States. So people can tap in all different ways, and you don't
right.
need to be a social worker or a lawyer to do anti-trafficking work. You can be an engineer or, you know, a programmer and do fabulous things. So there's all different ways for students the public to tap in and really assist in this effort.
Right. Fantastic. So we're almost out of time. So two quick follow-up questions to that. Gretchen, you talked about the way that this is really long-term and takes years of effort to overcome the trauma, the multiple intersecting traumas involved. Are we mostly forced to rely on volunteer labor for people to do that, or do we have? I mean, so the thing that pops into my mind is if you want medical or if you want psychiatric or psychological care on your private health insurance, you end up they need a diagnosis, they need it limited, I guess my question is, it takes time. And will our insurers be willing to give it that time? And if not, then where will the budget come from for people to do that work?
Yeah, so for trafficking survivors here in Kentucky and really across the country, because the federal government funds many programs through the Office of Victims of Crime and through other departments to provide comprehensive services to victims of labor and sex trafficking, whether or not they've reported to law enforcement. So all of those wraparound things, therapy, legal assistance, housing assistance, employment assistance, that is not to say it at all meets the need that exists out there. And I think The need for therapy is one major one that exists, but there are organizations that can help individuals navigate that, whether or not they have insurance to cover that or whether their insurance will cover it. I would also point to, in Kentucky, our network of rape crisis centers and domestic violence programs are a tremendous resource for this population because they provide free and confidential services. And so a lot of times there are, while it may not fit exactly in the box of trafficking, there are trained professionals who can do crisis counseling, some can do long-term therapy, that can really address a lot of this trauma. And that's a huge resource here in Kentucky for folks to access.
Right. And here's a slightly selfish final question. According to relatively recent numbers, something like 30% of public university students experience housing vulnerability. Maybe 50% experience some kind of food insecurity. There's likely to be a good bit of advantage taking and exploitation of even college students. I know that, you know, it's not 200 hours of training, but again, what kinds of things would you see at the level that where I might see it in my students, for instance, or my students might see it amongst themselves?
I don't think the fact that they're college students who have these challenges is going to make it any different than if they're the kid who isn't living in poverty. I mean, it's the same challenge. It's just a different environment. So things like recruiting for fast money, you know, in strip clubs, or online sex ad posting and things like that, those are quick money things.
Yeah.
And so people can be convinced that that's going to be the way that I'm going to get through school. Unfortunately, there's usually going to be some other person who's going to show them how to make that quick money when we're talking, you know, when we're talking about the sex trade, and ultimately become that person in power and control over them.
Right.
So I don't think that it would present any differently. You would still be looking for that manipulative, controlling person who takes advantage of their desperation, for lack of a better word, that I am living in my car, or I don't have food to eat because I'm trying to get through school. That would be a population that I could see them very much preying on, because
right.
they know who are the vulnerable people. They're very smart. Traffickers are very smart and manipulative, and so they will see that as another population that they can prey on.
And I think we need to make it clear to everybody in our lives that we care about their well-being, that we care about their safety in their work, in their classrooms, in their relationships, and talk more openly with people about their emotional, physical, economic safety.
Right.
And just be more comfortable with those conversations. So campuses have done a lot to talk about campus sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's helped, some of it hasn't. But those same discussions can go on in terms of, what are safety in your relationships? What does it look like to have a good employer? You know, those kinds of things that can be very helpful to assist young people to navigate the world.
Right.
You know, they're on a college campus. They can learn all these skills and then go out in the world and be safer as well.
Well, Allison Taylor, Gretchen Hunt, thank you so much for your time. This has been really informative and emotional, actually. So thank you so much for being on Things Forward.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
That's all the time we have on Ethics Forward this week. You might want to mark down the numbers that victims advocate Gretchen Hunt and Director of Prevention and Prosecution Allison Taylor mentioned. They're 1-888-373-7888 for the Human Trafficking Hotline, and for the Child Abuse, Adult Abuse Hotline, 1-877-KY-SAFE-1. That's 1-877-597-2331. Ethics Forward comes to you every Tuesday at 6 p.m., Wednesday at 10 a.m., and Thursday at 8 a.m. on 106.5 FM Forward Radio in lovely downtown Louisville, Kentucky. If you're outside Jefferson County or away from a radio, you can stream the show and all of our Forward Radio content at forwardradio.org. You can also find virtually the entire Ethics Forward SoundCloud archive at forwardradio.org/ethicsforward. Ethics Forward always benefits from the music and production help of Prismic, who's also on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/prismicofficial. You're hearing Prismic right now. I'm also grateful for the strategic and editing support of Maddie Claybo and to the U of L Philosophy Department, which makes her work possible. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.